This particular panel is one I've been looking forward to for 6 months. I grew up in the New York City area, in New Jersey actually, and I had the thrill of watching both Bobby Brown and Eddie Robinson play baseball. And I never thought I'd get to meet them. And today, I'm so fortunate to have them both on the stage with us. In fact, I told Eddie last night that I saw him go 4 for 5 against the Yankees, and Bobby says, yeah, I remember that game. Our moderator today is well known to all of you. His day job is as the professor of law and the former dean at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University. By night, he's the president of the Ernie Banks and Bobby Bragan Sabre chapter. And when he has some spare time, he likes to write baseball books. Most recently, he wrote Lucky Me, My 66 Years in Baseball, in collaboration with Eddie Robinson. Please welcome Paul Rogers.
Thanks, Bob. As president of the neighboring chapter, this is my only chance to say publicly what a great job I think Bob and the Durker and the Hornsby chapters have done putting this on. It's been a great convention. Well, I've been looking forward to this panel too. We've got three men here who have had remarkable careers in baseball on and off the field. And if you think about it, it's relatively rare that an outstanding player becomes a successful front office executive. And we've got three that made that transition. So I'm going to introduce them by seniority. First is Eddie Robinson, who had actually 65 years in baseball. As a player, coach, farm director, and general manager and scout, Eddie grew up in the Depression in Paris, Texas, in a one-parent family, and became a member of America's Greatest Generation when he served in World War II. He had a 13-year big league career played for every American League team except the Red Sox. I'm not sure what to make. And it's interesting, we were counting it at breakfast that Eddie has drawn a paycheck from 13 different teams in his career. That's probably a record. As a player, he was a four-time All-Star, played in two World Series. He, of course, was the first baseman on the 48 Indians that won the World Series, and all of you probably know that's the last time the Indians won the World Series. He hit 29 home runs in 1951 for the White Sox in spacious Comiskey Park, and that held the team record for almost 30 years. He was the seventh player to hit a ball over the roof at Comiskey. Some of you could probably name the other six, but we got to move on here. So I'll just tell you who they are. Ruth, Gehrig, Fox, Greenberg, Williams, and Mantle. And Robinson. Now, some of you also probably know that Ted Williams said publicly time and again that Eddie Robinson was the most underrated hitter that he ever played against. So that's pretty high praise as well. After his playing career, he coached and scouted for the Orioles and then followed Paul Richards right here to Houston when the quote 45s were formed. He was involved in the first expansion draft and was farm director here for 5 years, and he was with the Astros when they signed Bob Watson, as a matter of fact. Um, And then he moved onward and upward and eventually served as the GM for the Atlanta Braves for 5 years, part of which was under Ted Turner, and then the Texas Rangers for 4.5 years. Along the way, he worked for Charlie Finley, Ted Turner, George Steinbrenner, and then our local hero, Eddie Chiles, and had an incredible career. Now, one thing that is largely forgotten about Eddie's playing career is that he was the MVP in the International League in 1946. It was a three-horse race. The other two were Jackie Robinson and Bobby Brown. So, please welcome Eddie Robinson. I'd also like to introduce Betty Robinson, who's here with us, who's been, if I'm counting right, the Robinsons will celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary next year. Betty? Now, Bobby Brown has also had a remarkable career, and I think we could say he took the road less traveled. He's probably the only person, only ball player ever signed out of the Tulane Medical School. In fact, he had a storied college playing career, and I'm sure this is a record. He's the only person who is in three college sports halls of fame. And if you can tell me who they are without looking it up afterwards, I'll give you a gold star. Actually, it's Stanford, UCLA, and Tulane. He, in fact, was signed by the Yankees for a record bonus on the condition that he could continue in medical school, and that's exactly what he did. Early on, he was dubbed the Golden Boy by the press, and he made the Yankees in 1947, and then he played with the Yankees until he was called to active service in the Korean conflict after the 1951 season. He appeared in four World Series, all won by the Yankees, and hit a combined 439. That is the highest batting average in World Series history for anybody with 20 or more at bats. After he served in Korea, he was reassigned to Japan, and in Japan, his wife Sarah could join him, and so they were serving in Japan when Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe came over on their honeymoon, and so Bobby and Sarah participated in the DiMaggio's honeymoon, and if he has time, he can tell you the story about inoculating Marilyn when she was going to Korea. So after Korea, he came back to the Yankees in 1954, but then he walked away from baseball at the age of 29 to begin his cardiology residency at Stanford. Was May 31st? Was your last game?
June 30th.
June 30th was his last game, 1954. He played in Fenway Park. And took the red eye to San Francisco to report for his residency training the following day. So remarkable to walk away from baseball at age 29, but baseball wasn't through with Dr. Brown. So he practiced cardiology in Fort Worth for 25 years. That was interrupted by a six-month stint in 1974 to serve as interim president of the Texas Rangers. And then in 1984, Dr. Brown retired from his practice and served as National League president for 10 years.
League.
I'm sorry, American League. Why did I write National League? American League president. I guess it was wishful thinking.
Not for me.
American League president for 10 years. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Bobby Brown. Now, it's a real treat for me to get to introduce Bob Watson because I've admired him from afar for about 45 years. He was, as you all know, also an outstanding major league ball player who later excelled as a front office executive. Bob grew up, or Bull as you all know him, grew up in the inner city of L.A. and was signed by the Astros when he was only 18. And progressing up the Astros minor league ladder, he was had to endure a lot of the what was still Jim Crow stuff in the Deep South. But he made his major league debut when he was only 20 years old, and he went on to play for 19 seasons, 14 of which were with the Astros. And he's, by any reckoning, one of the top Astro hitters of all time. He made two All-Star teams, and he was also a great clutch hitter. The Bull batted .318 for the New York Yankees in the 1981 series and hit two home runs. And in 17 postseason games, hit a combined .371. He's also the first player to hit for the cycle in both leagues. And as all of you know, he scored Major League Baseball's millionth run in 1975. After he retired as a player in 1984, Bob spent 4 years as the hitting coach for the Oakland A's before coming back to Houston in 1988 as assistant general manager of the Astros, the first African-American to hold a position like that. He was named the Astros GM in 1993 and then became the GM of the Yankees in 1996. In spite of serious medical problems, he led the Yankees to the World Series championship that year, stamping the team with his imprint very, very quickly. It was, for those of you that might not remember, it was the first Yankee championship in 18 years. He later served as Major League Vice President, where he became known as the Czar of Discipline before he retired in 2010. As you can see, Bob Watson had a very distinguished career on and off the field. Please join me in welcoming Bob Watson. And Carol Watson is here too, and I know she's been with him through all of his trials and tribulations and triumphs. So Carol. So I hope this is sort of a free-ranging discussion, but to start it off, I thought I might ask the panelists whether they if they aspired to the front office when they were still playing. Was that a career goal, or if not, what turned them to want to be a front office executive? Because as I said, it is very rare for top-notch, top-line, all-star caliber ballplayers to be front office executives. So, Bull, why don't I start with you?
I was taking batting practice, one of the rare times I did take batting practice, in Atlanta. And Bill Lucas, who was serving as, farm director, general manager, but not having the title, he was out watching batting practice, and he says, "What are you going to do when you finish playing?" I said, "We really hadn't thought about it, you know, because I was still in the middle of my career." And he says, "Why don't you think about, coming upstairs and helping put teams together, helping the scouting and whatever." That was it. And that was in the, mid-70s. I retired in 84 in Atlanta. And I talked to Hank Aaron, and I told him, I said, that I might want to think about being a hitting coach. And he says, "Well, by far, go after it." Well, I didn't do it with Atlanta, but I went to Oakland, and this name pops up many, many times in my career. Sandy Alderson was the general manager, and in that interview, he asked me what was my ultimate goal. I'm interviewing for the hitting coach's job. I told him I wanted to sit in his chair. Okay. And he says, "You know what? I'll help you." So I was hitting coach by season, and taking all kinds of notes and basically assistant GM in the off season, and that's how it started for me.
Eddie, you want to follow up?
Yeah, I'm going to get my own microphone. I don't want to share it with Bobby.
Well, here, take this one. No, and I'll get this one.
I'm going down here.
They tried to tell you something by not giving me one.
Okay. I always wanted to be in the front office of baseball when I was through playing. And I remember talking to Lee McPhail when I was with the Yankees and telling him that of my desire, I wanted to be in player development. And then farm director at that time was really a good job in baseball. And I would have been happy with that, but as Chris, I got to be general manager. Anyway, I had a champion in Paul Richards, who was my manager in Chicago, and he knew I wanted to stay in baseball. Paul's from Waxahachie, Texas, and he was my mentor. I love the guy, and when I was through playing, he was manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and I wound up my career with the Orioles, and he gave me a job as a in the farm department, in the player development department. And then in 1961, we came to Houston, and when they didn't have a team, and we selected the first Houston Astro team, and signed Durker, signed Bob. Bob said he was signed in 64, and I was here from the beginning through the 1965 season. So I didn't know what a prize we had here, but it turned out to be a good one. And anyway, that's Paul. That's, I always wanted to be a general manager.
So Bobby, did you ever want to be a general manager?
Never. I mean, being in the executive office of baseball it wasn't even a remote thought, none. I graduated from medical school in 1950, and of course, I then went on to play a couple more years. I was in World War II. I was in the Navy, but I was in uniform, but on the campus the whole time because I was a pre-med, and they didn't want to run out of doctors before the war ended. So, anyway, I never wanted to, had no thoughts of ever being in baseball in an executive fashion. In 1974, one of my friends bought the Rangers. It was Brad Corbett, and he had not had any experience in baseball. And in the process of trying to buy the team, he would ask me every once in a while how much he should offer and so forth and so on. And I helped him a little bit. And so when he finally did buy the team, he asked me if I'd go out there for a while and just kind of keep track of things and hope that they didn't make any real bad mistakes. And so I went out with the Rangers for 6 months and then went back to my practice. In 1984, Eddie Childs, the owner of the Rangers, brought his wife into me for me to see her as a patient. And then we struck up a conversation thereafter. And he asked me eventually if I would be interested in interviewing for the job of commissioner. And I never thought of that. I said, well, I don't know. Let me think about it. And I was going to turn 60 that year. And I was practicing 25 years, night and day. And I was getting tired. And I knew that I could go another 5 years, but not any longer than that. But here was a baseball thing. I mean, doctors can't do anything if they retire from medicine. You know, they sell suits or houses or something like that. But here was something in baseball, and I didn't need any refresher course in baseball. So I said, yes, I'll go up and interview. And I had two interviews for the commissioner's job. And then at the second meeting, they told me that they wanted really a businessman. And I said, well, I don't qualify for that. And they said they were going to select Peter Ueberroth, which was an excellent, excellent choice. At any rate, they then turned to me and said Lee McPhail was retiring from being the president of the American League, and would I be interested in that? I said, well, I didn't think so. I was going to have to move to New York and whatnot. But I said, let me talk to Lee about it, because he was a friend. His dad had actually participated in signing me for the Yankees. And he said, it's a great job. It's a baseball job. It's better than the commissioner's job. He said, they're dealing with the labor union and with TV and all that stuff. He said, baseball, the American League is a baseball job. So I thought about it for a while. I said, I think I'll give that a whirl. And that's how I became the president of the American League. And I was there for 10 years. And when I was going to turn 70, I thought I better get home before they told me I was too old. And I went home.
Bobby, you're talking about the rigors of practicing medicine. You've got I know you have a story about a conversation you had with Yogi Berra about medicine.
Well, Yogi and I roomed together at Newark, and his education, you might say, was very spotty. And I felt that he was going to have to do well in baseball and stay in it for as long as he could, and I kept preaching to him when I was rooming with him that he had to stay in shape, he had to do what he was supposed to do, and I said, you got to hang in this business for as long as you can. I said, you got to save your money and behave yourself and just try to do as well as you can and last as long as you can. Well, he took my advice. He never had another job. He stayed in baseball his whole life and was a tremendous success. And not only a success as far as his work ethic was concerned, but he did fabulously well in the financial matters and became extremely wealthy and still is. And so in the time that he was the coach with the Yankees, he came to Arlington with the Yankee team, and I called him, and we decided to have breakfast on a Thursday morning, and I went out there to talk to him and visit with him. And after breakfast, I said, what are you going to do today? He said, I'm going to play golf. He said, I take my clubs with me on the road. He said, you know, I don't have to pay when I play. I said, that's a surprise. I never thought of that. So I said, what do you do after you play? Well, he said, I play 9 or 18 holes. And then he said, I get a little bite to eat, and I head for the park about 3 or 3:30. And he said, when I'm out at the park, he said, I just hang around the batting cage, and if they ask me anything about hitting, I talk to them about it. If they don't ask me, I don't say anything. I just pick up the fungo bat, and I hit ground balls to the infielders. I said, what about the game? What do you do then? He said, I sit next to the manager. If he asks me any questions, I give him answers. If he doesn't ask me questions, I just watch the game. And he said, after the game, we have that big feed. We have a big dinner afterwards, that buffet thing. And then he said, I go to the hotel, and I like to watch those midnight movies, and I watch the movie till I fall asleep. And then I get up the next morning, and that's kind of my days when I'm on the road. He said, what do you do during the day? I said, well, I get up at 6, and I make rounds in the hospital. I have to have breakfast, and I'm in the hospital by 7. I make rounds till 9, see all my patients. I said, then I head for the office. I see patients till 5. He said, what about lunch? I said, we don't have time for lunch. I said, we have some crackers and tuna fish or peanut butter and stuff like that. But I said, we don't have time for lunch. I said, I read cardiograms and make my phone calls during lunch. But then at 5 o'clock, I head back to the hospital. I see the people in the coronary care units that were having trouble, so I see them. And then if I have any consults, I do those consults. And I get home anytime between 8 and 10, and I have dinner, and we go to bed about 10:30, and I get to sleep about midnight. And that's kind of my day. And I don't, he said, you do that every day. I said, yeah, but I said, if I'm on call, I have the nights too. I have to get up at night once or twice usually. And I said, if I have the weekend, it's a 48 hours where you don't get much rest. He said, "You do that all the time?" I said, "Yeah, pretty much all the time." He looked at me and said, "Where the hell do you think you went wrong?"
So while we're on the topic of yogi, Bob Netty, do you have any yogi stories?
Well, I tell you what, Yogi was very instrumental in helping me in postseason. You know, unfortunately, my career here with the Astros, we didn't make the postseason, so I had no experience when I got up to New York, and Yogi's there, and I said, "Yogi, how do you handle this?" He says, "It's like playing in your backyard, you know?" And I said, "Gee whiz." He says, "I tell you what, though, when you go out, they call your name, when you get out on the line, your knees are going to be shaking, your stomach is going to be boiling, but all that goes away once the game starts, and they hit the ball to you, you catch it, right?" Yeah. "And when they throw it to you, you hit it, right?" He says, "It's like playing in your backyard." And I said, "Yogi, is that what you did for all those years playing in World Series?" He said, "Yeah, I have, 14 World Series rings. I did pretty good, didn't I?" I said, "Thank you."
Eddie, will you tell your...
I got a good one.
It is a good one.
When I was with the Yankees, one time we played a night game, and we were playing a doubleheader the next day. And so I felt that I didn't want to take batting practice. So if you didn't take batting practice, you didn't have to get to the ballpark as early. And I got there late, and when I got there, they were taking batting practice. And as I'm getting my uniform on, the batting practice is over, and the players are filing into the locker room. And as soon as Yogi came through the door, he came right over to my locker and said, "Where the hell were you today?" I said, "Well, Yogi, I didn't want to take batting practice, and so I got here late." He said, "Well, you really missed it." And I said, "What did I miss?" He said, "There were two streakers." He said, "They jumped on the field down the right field line at the foul pole, and they ran all the way across the field to the left field foul pole and jumped up in the stands and ran off." He said, "They didn't have any clothes on." I said, "Well, I guess I did miss it. What were they, boys or girls?" Thought for a second, "I don't know, they had bags on their head."
How many of you have heard the comic book story? Well, I think you should hear it from the source.
Well, at Newark, that was my first year, and the war ended in August of 45, and in January of 46, I got discharged from the Navy, and I signed with the Yankees, and they assigned me to AAA in New York. And Yogi and I roomed together. And I had to take a pathology and a pharmacology exam when I got back to school. And it was just the final exam because I lacked finishing those two courses, which were two of the three major courses in the sophomore year, the second year. And so pathology was going to be the difficult test. And so I got the textbook. It was Boyd's Pathology, and I used to carry it with me on the road when we went on the road, and I would study that textbook because I couldn't very well take my microscope on the road. I thought that would be a little bit too much of a shock for the team, to be honest with you. So I would read that textbook, and so I was reading it one day, and Yogi, he would read Superman comics, and you could get them for a dime, and he'd buy a dollar's worth at the store, and then he'd come up there with those Superman comics. So we both finished reading one day, and he put down his Superman comics, and I closed my textbook, and he said, "You just can't beat these Superman comics." He said, "You just can't beat him." He said, "How did yours turn out?"
Bob, as you all know, scored the 1 millionth run, and I think it'd be interesting to sort of hear that story from the person who scored the run.
Well, I tell you, that's not something that is one of your goals. at the start of the season, you know, you set these goals. But, you know, the season starts, and they say they have this big countdown. Somebody has got their calculator out, and, hey, the millionth run is going to be scored sometime during the season. So they had this big contest, and you know, kids around the country put in names and dates of who's going to score the millionth run on such and such a date. Well, you know, it goes on, and we were going on a West Coast road trip from here, and it doesn't rain too often in San Francisco. I mean, rain enough to rain out a game. If there was not a rain out on the Saturday, May 3rd, I wouldn't have scored the millionth run, because on Sunday, May 4th, we played the first game of a doubleheader that started at noon. And when the game started, they had on the big scoreboard out there, I think the number was 8. So the games in the East are going on, you know. So you don't pay any attention to that when, you know, you're playing. John Montefusco, the count, he's pitching for San Francisco. He goes 1-2-3 in the first inning, and I can't remember who's pitching for us, but 1-2-3. But by the time I lead off the second, hitting fourth, the number's down to 2, okay? Oh, the count, he walks me on 4 pitches. All right, so I'm on first base. He's still on 2. J.L. Cruz is hitting behind me. He walks on 4 pitches. So I'm on second now. It's down to 1, okay? Milt May, knowing that he's going to get a cookie to hit. He's thrown 8 straight balls. Milt May hits the first pitch. He hits it in those temporary bleachers they were building out in Candlestick. I'm jogging like everybody else does on a home run. In those days, the visiting bullpen was behind third base and down the line a little bit. When I get to third base, the guys in the bullpen say, "Run, run, run." Not knowing that Dave Concepcion in Cincinnati has hit a ball out of the ballpark. Okay? He is low flying around the bases. I think he ran it in, 13-1 or something. You know, well, the guys in the bullpen tell me to run. So I get it in gear and I zoom. I beat him by 1.5 seconds. So I got the million. He's 1,000,001. And then J.L. Cruz and Milt May. Well, I come in. Now, between games, they take my shoes. Let me tell you, back in the day, they weren't like the shoes they have now where you get them out the box and wear. Well, you had to break those bad boys in, you know? And this was May. I had just got them comfortable. There were the yellowback kangaroos. You know, they were good. They took my shoes to the Hall of Fame. But that, I'm in the Hall of Fame, please. One other thing, for scoring the run. The number one sponsor was Tootsie Roll, and the number two sponsor was Seiko. Well, Tootsie Roll gave me 1 million Tootsie Rolls. Seiko gave then, Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner. He got a platinum watch. I got a platinum watch that I've never worn. It's in a nice wood case in the safe deposit box. And the president of Seiko, there's three platinum watches commemorating the millionth run. But the guys on the team, they gave a replica of that watch with an engraved date and time and all of that for helping me score the millionth run.
So, Eddie, you had a chance encounter with Marilyn Monroe when you were with the White Sox. Did you tell them that story?
Yeah. When I was with the White Sox, they trained in Pasadena, California. And they trained at Brookside Park, which was right across the street from Rose Bowl. And we used to go over to the Rose Bowl and have lunch and thought that was a big deal. But one day we go out early and get ready to do a day's practice. And this really good-looking gal shows up in shorts and a tight halter top. And she's there for a photo shoot, publicity photo shoot. And her partner was going to be Gus Zernial, who was a big, handsome guy. He belonged in that photo shoot. Anyway, they spent the whole day. He and the photographers and the girl, and they did all kind of photos. But and then that was it. Everybody kind of forgot about it. But the next week, we got to the ballpark, and there was a picture of that girl. It was Marilyn Monroe. And she had a picture in everybody's locker and with a little inscription on it, with love to so-and-so. Mine said, with love to Eddie, Marilyn Monroe. Well, all that was great, but she spelled Eddie, E-D-I. And this is where I really went wrong. I said, anybody can't spell Eddie better than that, I don't want their photo, and I tore it up. But I'm pretty sure that after that, Joe DiMaggio wanted to meet Marilyn, and he asked Gus if he couldn't kind of set it up, and Gus did. I think Gus introduced Marilyn Monroe to Joe D.
So, Bobby, to follow up on that, would you like to tell them about being on their honeymoon?
Well, in Korea, I was NMD playing with the Yankees, so I qualified for the Yankees draft when the Korean War came along. And they had a special notice from the Surgeon General that I was to be sent to the Far East. I was the one guy that they fingered to go to the Far East before we even got in there. And because the AMA at the time, the American Medical Association, was complaining they were taking doctors they didn't need. Now they got a big league ball player and a doctor, and they didn't want me playing on some camp team in the States. So they had the word to send me to the Far East, and that's how I ended up in Korea. And I was the battalion surgeon for the 160th Field Artillery Battalion in the 45th Division up on the line. So when I had enough points, I went over to on R&R to Tokyo. And all of the doctors that were in boot camp with me, doctors boot camp, were a lot of them were at the Tokyo Army Hospital, which was the major medical facility in Japan at that time for the services. And so I decided I would transfer to Japan, and I had plenty enough points to do so. So I ended up in the hospital in Japan, and I brought my wife Sarah and my son, whom I had never seen, because he was born when I was en route to the Far East. So we were there when I read in Stars and Stripes that Joe DiMaggio in Maryland and Lefty O'Doul, the manager of the SEALs, San Francisco SEALs, were coming over to Japan, and they were going to conduct clinics for the Japanese major league teams that spring that were in spring training. So they were going to stay at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, and I left word at the desk to have Mr. DiMaggio call me when he arrived. And Sarah's all excited. My wife Sarah was all excited because Marilyn was going to be with him, obviously. So they came in this day, and they flew into Haneda Airport, which at that time was over near Yokohama. And they were to get in about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I got home that evening at about 5 o'clock from the hospital, and I asked Sarah if Joe had called. She said, no, he hasn't called. I said, well, you never know with Joe. He may not call. I said, if he feels like it, he'll call. If he doesn't feel like it, he won't call. So don't worry about it. So we had dinner, and then about 6:30, the phone rang, and it was Joe. He said, we just got here. He said, we just got here. He said, Lefty told us. He said, if we come over here and help him with the clinics, you can honeymoon. And he said, no one will know you in this foreign country. You can go anywhere you want, and no one will bother you. And that appealed to Joe, because he was mobbed everywhere he went. He said, we got off that airplane, and we just now got here. He said they had 7 million people lining the streets just to look at us. So we went down there. He said, come on down, eat dinner. I said, we've already eaten. Let me. He said, come down for dessert. I said, okay. I said, let me talk to Sarah and see if she wants to go. She had gone upstairs in a little Japanese house to get ready, put her nightgown on and so forth. And she heard me on the phone. She said, I'm putting on my stockings. And so we went down to the Imperial Hotel, and we had dessert with them. And that's when they decided that Marilyn wanted to go to Korea. She wanted to go talk to the kids over in Korea. We had maybe 500,000 troops still in Korea, and she wanted to go over and visit with them. And she did, and Joe was mad. He said he hated the Army. Hey, you don't have to go over there. He said, we paid our way over here. You're not obligated to go. He said, I got to go, Joe. He said, you got to take all those shots and everything. She said, what do you mean shots? She said, you know, they give you those shots for all those diseases. And he looked at me. He said, no, she has to take those shots. I said, yeah, she'll have to be inoculated for typhoid and tetanus and diphtheria and a few other things. I said, yeah. And she said to Joe, will it leave a scar? And Joe said, oh, no, maybe about that big, but it won't be bad. She said, Joe, I can't have a scar like that on my body. And she said to me, will it leave a scar? I said, no, Marilyn, it won't leave a scar. So over she went to Korea. And before she went, in the Stars and Stripes, Joe had given this report to the press when they interviewed him. He said, there will be no Army doctor see Mrs. DiMaggio unless it's Lieutenant Brown. And from all this, the Stars and Stripes went to every serviceman in Japan, Korea, Okinawa, and wherever they were, all over the Far East. And in the headquarters in Tokyo, the phone calls began coming in from all over. Who is Lieutenant Brown, you know? So that's the way we started on the honeymoon, and she came on back, and Gene O'Doul, and I think that was her name, O'Doul, and Marilyn and Sarah, they went shopping and hung around, and we had a great time. And then she got viral pneumonia and was really sick, and she was down at the Imperial Hotel when she got back from Korea, was just sick. And Joe called me and asked me if I could come down because she just wasn't feeling well. And people have asked, what did you think about that when Joe called you to go down and see Marilyn? I said, as a patient. And I said, I better study that Hippocratic Oath a couple times before I go down there. So I went down there, and she was sicker than the devil, and I got the internist that was in the army there in Tokyo to come see her and took care of her. But then we were on the honeymoon, and we spent about 10 days together, and it was wonderful. She was a good gal. She was a nice person. She was excited. Sarah was pregnant with our second child, and she... Marilyn was anxious to get pregnant, and she had hoped that she could have children and so forth, and it was just, she was just a nice, nice person.
Well, we've got some questions in the from the audience in the few minutes that we have left, and this is for Bob Watts, and this is a typical Sabre question. It says you hit 410 against Jerry Kuzman. You hit 290 against Steve Carlton, 323 against Tom Seaver with two home runs, but only 233 against Don Sutton. So can you explain the Sutton average?
That 233 against Don Sutton cost him 3 no-hitters, and 4 shutouts. And in his induction speech into Cooperstown, I was named one of the 5 toughest hitters. Okay, and what did he say? I hit 233 against him? And it was a lot more than that.
Well, in any event, it was a hard 233. This is a question for Eddie, and I know he's got a good story to respond to this. When you were Braves GM, when Ted Turner bought the team. Do you have a story about that? Have a story about Ted Turner?
About the photograph, eh?
About Ted Turner.
When you were GM.
Yeah, well, he bought the team. The Atlanta Braves while I was general manager there. And he didn't know anything about baseball, but he had a lot of, he was very opinionated. And you asked me something that I'm not, I don't know exactly what you want to hear from.
Well, it's the story about when you were leaving for the Rangers. You wanted to leave for the Rangers, he wanted to keep you.
Oh, yeah. So I think Bobby had something to do with my coming to Texas. Anyway, Brad Corbett, who's owner of the Rangers, started courting me to come over and be the general manager of the Rangers. And I was very pleased about that. And but I was torn. I'd had a good time in Atlanta, and Turner and I were warming up to each other. And so I told Ted, I said, Ted, I think I'm going to go over to Texas, and I've got an offer to go over there. And he said, oh, I don't want you to do that. And I said, well, he said, do me a favor. First of all, when Ted came with the Braves, he was driving a kind of an old beat up Toyota. And in the stadium in Atlanta, the executives and the staff parked down in the tunnel, and you had your name on the wall, and I had a brand new Cadillac. The club was providing it, but I was parking right in front of Ted, and he didn't like that a bit. But we got over that anyway. He said, He said, I wish you'd wait a week before you make your final decision to go to Texas. And I said, he said, let me tell you a story. He said, you know, my father committed suicide and my grandfather committed suicide. And he said, so it's in the family. Anyway, he said, when I was growing up in Nashville, I had this beautiful girlfriend and I was really in love with her. And she threw me over for another guy. And he said, I was so despondent that I decided that I was going to kill myself. And he said, I went down and rented a room in the tallest hotel in town on the top floor, and that I was going to jump out the window. So he said, I went up there and I got up in the window and I'm ready to jump. And he said, I told myself, wait a minute, Ted, you don't have to do it today. You can do it tomorrow. And so he said, I got down out of the window. Next day went up there, told myself again. And he said, after 4 days, he said, I figured you don't have to kill yourself at all. So he said, now, if you'll just think about this for 7 days, you may decide you don't want to go to Texas. That's a true story.
Unlike all the others you've heard. Well, I think we have time for one more story from Dr. Brown. And so let's go back and have him tell us another yogi story.
No.
Yeah.
Tell you, there's a plot against me here. The yogi, as Bob intimated, reduced hitting to its simplest form. You know, if he could reach it, he could hit it. And he didn't care where it was. And, of course, Fred Hutchinson, who pitched for Detroit, was a finesse pitcher and a good one and tough. And people, all the hitters had trouble with Fred. He was a very good pitcher, but Yogi could hit him really well because Yogi didn't think much about anything. I hear him now talking to the player sitting on the ball coming inside or outside. Yogi never did that. All he knew was the ball was coming into the plate, and if he could reach it, he could hit it. So in those days, the pitchers, a lot of time before the games, they had the pitching rubber on both sides of home plate, that was over on toward the sidelines, and the pitchers a lot of times warmed up there, not in the bullpen, and the people could see them warming up. So now this day, where Fred Hutchinson, who had a violent temper, was warming up, and Yogi said to me, "Watch Hutch now, watch Hutch." And Yogi's got a bat in his hand. He's on Hutch, Hutch. You pitching today, Hutch? And he's got that bat in his hand, see, waving it. And Hutchinson looks over there, mad as hell, you know, that Yogi's screaming at him. So now the game starts in the first inning. We're in Briggs Stadium. And Yogi comes up, and I think he was hitting third. And Hutch had got two quick strikes on him and then decided he was going to waste a pitch. So he threw one about the peak of his hat. And Yogi went, "Whoa!" And that thing went into the upper deck. The wasted pitch, see, went into the upper deck. Now he starts in his home run trot. And, you know, he had that funny body and kind of waddled. And he's running down to first base. And then takes the turn at first and heads for second. And suddenly Hutchinson charges off the mound. And he runs over to the infield. And he starts screaming at Yogi between first and second base. And he keeps screaming at him. And Yogi's watching him. And he hit second base, and then he started for third. Hutch is right with him, running right along, screaming at him. He went to third, and he started coming home. Hutch is still hollering at him. And when he got halfway to home, Hutch went back to the mound, and Yogi crossed home plate and came into the dugout. I said, "What was Hutch screaming at you?" He said, "He kept hollering at me. Run on all fours like you're supposed to. Run on all fours like you're supposed to."
Well, I think we'll end with this one, that one, since we need to keep on schedule. But let's thank our panel. Yeah.